From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Bette Midler. She's currently performing with her backup singers, the Harlettes, on her Divine Miss Millennium tour. Also today, we remember actor and writer Quentin Crisp with a 1986 interview about his experiences in the 1930s and 40s as an openly homosexual man who wore more makeup than was considered appropriate for women. Crisp died Sunday at the age of 90. And we remember Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm of the Sir Douglas Quintet and the Texas Tornadoes. He died last Thursday at the age of 58. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Coast Guard officials say they've recovered the bodies of six Cuban immigrants who drowned when their small boat sank as they tried to reach the south coast of Florida. That makes a total of seven bodies found out of 13 believed to be aboard the boat when it went down in rough weather. A man and a woman managed to struggle ashore on Key Biscayne, and a five-year-old boy was found clinging to an inner tube off the coast near Fort Lauderdale. The boy was released today from a Florida hospital. The Coast Guard said today that it won't send the three survivors back to Cuba. After the bonfire collapse that killed 12 people last week at Texas A&M, a huge crowd of fans cheered the university's football team to victory today. Diane Hodges reports.
The largest crowd to ever watch a football game in Texas packed Kyle Field, most of them Texas Aggies, rooting for the university, which is still coming to terms with the deaths of 12 of their own. Buddy Bradford graduated nearly 40 years ago from Texas A&M and believes the team had 12 angels watching over them.
I'll memorize where they're from and their names, and I'll, you know, be getting up before, you know, church retreats and praying for all their families, and without even, you know, they're imprinted in my soul, heart and soul.
The University of Texas paid its respects during halftime by playing Amazing Grace and flying the Aggie flag. For NPR News, I'm Diane Hodges in College Station.
American safety investigators are on their way home from Egypt after a week of looking into the crash of Egypt Air Flight 990. They met with Egyptian aviation officials and reviewed the backgrounds of the plane's crew. Egyptian officials have been resistant to the theory that the crash may have been caused by one of the plane's co-pilots. Croatia's highest court has declared critically ill President Franjo Tudjman temporarily unfit to govern and transferred his powers to the Speaker of Parliament. NPR's Sarah Chase reports.
The court's decree follows a recommendation the Croatian cabinet adopted yesterday. It gives the Speaker of the Parliament the right to promulgate laws and call elections. That has to be done before January 27th to avoid a constitutional crisis. Though Tudjman has been critically ill for a month, the whole process of formally admitting he's not able to govern has been painful for Croatian political leaders. He's revered as the father of contemporary Croatia. Tudjman was the architect of its nationalist project. He carried it out with no sensitivity for the country's large ethnic Serb minority, whose memory of the sadistic Croatian ustashas during World War II was inflamed by Belgrade's propaganda. The clash sparked the war in the Balkans. Later, in 1995, Tudjman's Croatia drove several hundred thousand Serbs out of the eastern part of the country. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Belgrade.
The Dow Industrials lost 20 points to end the day at 10,989. This is NPR. Emergency officials in Norway say at least 10 people died and 12 are still missing after a ferry boat sank in rough seas. Rescuers managed to save more than 60 passengers, but some are reported to be in danger from hypothermia. NASA scientists are eagerly awaiting new pictures of Jupiter's moon Io. Yesterday, the Galileo spacecraft made the closest flyby ever. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
NASA scientists had been saving this risky move until the end of Galileo's mission, and trouble began with just 4 hours to go on Thursday night. A dose of radiation from Jupiter caused the spacecraft to partially shut down. But team members revived Galileo before it hurtled just 186 miles above Io's surface. In Greek mythology, Io is the daughter of a river god, but Jupiter's moon is a fiery place. Over 100 volcanoes cover its surface. Some spit debris out into space. Data from Galileo may teach scientists about what Earth was like millions of years ago. The craft has incurred some lasting damage from radiation, but scientists would like to extend its mission. If Galileo had an odometer, it would now read over a billion miles. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Canada and China signed a bilateral agreement today that helps to clear the way for China's entry into the World Trade Organization. The deal, which is similar to one reached between China and the U.S. earlier this month, calls for a cut in tariffs on Canadian exports to China. China is Canada's fourth largest trading partner. In order to get enough support to join the WTO, China must still reach market opening agreements with other key members of the group, including the European Union. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bette Midler is touring the country in what she's calling the Divine Miss Millennium Tour. It ends with performances in Vegas, New Year's Eve, and January 1st. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1998 interview with Bette Midler, recorded after the release of her CD, Bathhouse Betty. It includes several songs that remind her of the ones she sang early in her career when she used to perform in a gay bathhouse in New York. Bette Midler started her recording career in 1972 and started her movie career with the 1979 film The Rose. Her other movies include Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Beaches, Scenes from a Mall, and The First Wives Club. She stars as novelist Jacqueline Suzanne in the film Isn't She Great, which is scheduled to open early next year. Bette Midler grew up in Hawaii. Before we hear from her, let's hear the song Ukulele Lady from her CD Bathhouse Betty.
I saw the splendor of the moonlight on Honolulu Bay. There's something tender in the moonlight on Honolulu Bay. And all the beaches are full of peaches.
You know, you always seemed so New York to me that when I learned that you were from Hawaii, I thought, no, that can't be.
Well, my parents actually made New York seem like the promised land. They talked a lot about it. They laughed about it. Their eyes lit up when they recalled their own childhoods in the East. And we all wanted to go there. My whole family, my sisters and I, we all wanted to go there. We thought, gosh, that must be so exciting. And in the end, we all did. As soon as my two sisters got out of college, they went, and I didn't spend very much time in college. I only spent about a year, and I came too, and I was instantly at home. So maybe all that talk about it was helpful.
Well, before you got to New York, did you feel at all like you were in the wrong place? As, a member of a Jewish family who was originally from New Jersey?
Well, I did and I didn't. I did because we were the only white people in our neighborhood. White people are called Howleys, and they don't distinguish between people who are Jewish and people who are Christians. They don't even care. They don't care what religion you are. You're white. That's that. So we were a Howley family in the midst of a Polynesian and mixed Polynesian community. And in one way, I did feel quite like the outsider because I was very interested. I love to read. I love to look at, to think about the theater. I loved the idea of show business. I loved all those things. And yet this environment, the natural environment was so extraordinary that I was completely at home. I used to watch the grass grow. I would lay down and watch the grass grow and talk to the ants and count the rocks and look at the sky and see the animals floating across the sky. And I was in heaven. I was completely in heaven. As long as I didn't have to go and be a Howley amongst this other community.
But you did, didn't you? I mean, you...
Yes, I did. So there was one part of me, one part of this life was very, you know, very unsettled and very uncomfortable. And yet the other part of it, when I was in nature, I was completely happy and completely at home.
Did you hear rhythm and blues or rock and roll when you were in Hawaii?
I remember very vividly when the first rock and roll song I ever heard, it was in the middle 50s, I think it was 55 or 56, and it was Ape Call. That was one. And then there was the one about the car. It was Nervous Norvis, I think, was making records, and Little Richard was making records. And those acts used to come to Hawaii. We had a terrific promoter there, and they all came through Hawaii. And I knew kids in the fifth and sixth grade who actually did get to go. I didn't get to go because I couldn't afford it. But the radio, there were a couple of really, really good radio stations there, and we heard it. And it was very, very exciting to us. Rhythm and blues I came to actually late in life, relatively late in life. When I came to New York, I met a couple of people who were just stone, hardcore rhythm and blues fanatics. And they started, we used to go home after our work and they would play these records for me. And I was completely carried away by it. And it still remains my first love. When I think about... pop music. I do love pop music, but my soul absolutely is stuck in rhythm and blues. And I should not forget that I'm also a Hawaiian music fanatic, which is something that people don't really know about me. I'm attached to that music in a very visceral way. I guess because we had a hula teacher kind of close to our house, and my mom sent me to hula class for a couple of years. And I mean, I really didn't get the dancing. I wasn't particularly good at the dancing. But boy, did I love that music. See, Hawaiian music, there's a lot of yodeling in it. And I always used to say that the men sing high and the women sing low. That's not necessarily true. But the group of performers that I was brought up with were exceptional musicians. And that's one of the great joys of being in that part of the world. People love to sing, and they love to dance, and they love to have a good time.
Would you do some Hawaiian vocalization or sing a little bit of a Hawaiian song for us?
Oh. Ulili'e, ulili'ho'e, ulili'ho'lo'ho'lo'ka'ka'hi'e, huia'ka'u'alana'mali'e. That's a very popular song. But... There are others. I in the back of my mind, I've always thought, oh, one of these days I'm going to make a Hawaiian album. But I don't think I'm going to get around to it at the rate I'm going. I only make a record once every couple of years or so.
Bette Midler's my guest. So you were telling us how you really wanted to get to New York when you were younger, and of course you finally did. I guess you were what, in your late teens?
I was 19 years old, just a couple of months shy of being 20.
And you felt like you had come home when you got there?
Basically, yes.
But there must have been stuff there that was so alien to you.
No, nothing. I fell right into it. I had no problem. Everything seemed just perfectly normal. The racket, the noise, the carry-on, people carrying on, the speed. It just seemed right. It all seemed right.
One of your big breaks when you came to New York was that you were, I think, first cast in the chorus of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway, and then became one of the daughters in it. Which songs did you get to sing in Fiddler?
I sang Matchmaker, and I sang, I think that's the only song I had a solo in. In the chorus I sang Frumacera's part one time. That was a great song. How can you allow it? How can you let your daughter take my place? I always loved that. And I loved the costume. What a costume. That was a fabulous, fabulous score.
What did you learn about music and theater from the theater people who you hung out with while doing Fiddler on the Roof?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I learned more when I was in Hawaii in the community theater, because they are very actory in community theater. There, you know, I guess because it's not a professional environment, the idea that people from the community come and are stars in these plays, you get the most flamboyant people in the entire community. So that our community theater was a hotbed of the most flamboyant types you could possibly imagine. And so I was, in fact, when I got to New York, I was kind of let down. Because we had real peacocks in our community theater, and they were definitely peahens in New York.
Now, how did you end up from Fiddler on the Roof to singing in the baths to an audience of gay men?
Well, I worked in the Fiddler on the Roof for 3 years, and I was determined to get another job in another show because I wanted to. I wanted the experience of other shows and playing other parts, of course, but I couldn't get another job. I was, I went to auditions, and I had my 8x10s, and I had all my songs, you know, and I was prepared. And I got called back many, many times, but I never actually got another job. And I finally said, well, gee, I don't get this. This isn't really happening for me. And so I looked around, and I was very lucky because there was a girl who was in the show with me, and she said, oh, come on down to come downtown with me. We're singing. Everyone's going to sing a few songs in this club. So I said, well, sure. And I got my little bag with my little songs, and I went down with her, and I sang, I'll never forget it, I sat down and I sang God Bless the Child, and something happened to me when I started singing that song. I was in another world, I was in a trance, and after that there was no looking back. I realized right then that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be alone. I didn't want to have, you know, two scenes in a show. I wanted to be the show, and after that I never looked back. I just went straight forward. And now I wound up here with you, Terry.
And a lucky break.
I'm here with you, and I just, and this is
the
where,
pinnacle
where it
of
led.
Your career.
All that work led to you.
Now we can just have the close credits and the end theme. So how did you actually get to the bath?
Well, I was, I put together a little, a few songs. And in those days, there were many rooms in New York where you were allowed to sing, to go from club to club. You could go from club to club and you could sing three songs a night. So I had a little route that I took along with my friends, and we would go from 9th Street to 70th Street and from 70th Street over to the East Side. And you would just make these little rounds, and depending on what time you got there, you would get to sing your three songs. And eventually I got more than three songs. I had maybe a repertoire of maybe 10 or 12 songs. And that's what's known as, you know, an act, at least an opening act. And I sort of settled in Bud's place, Bud Friedman's place. He had a place called the Improv on 44th. And it was a mix of singers and comics. And I was one of the more popular singers at that time. And I was still taking little classes here and there at HB Studio down in the Village. And this gentleman named Mr. Ostro called one of the teachers there and said, do you have anybody that can that has a little bit of an act? I need someone to come and work in my bathhouse. And the guy that he was speaking to was a teacher of mine. And he said, sure, I know someone, and he called me up, and he said, look, this guy's going to call you, and you should be prepared. He needs a singer. He's willing to pay $300 a week, $300 for the two nights or whatever it was. And I said, where is it? And he said, oh, it's in a gay bathhouse. And I said, oh, okay. And Stephen Ostro called me, and he told me what the situation was, and I went down, I looked at the place, I said, well, it looks perfectly fine to me. He had an excellent piano player, and he had an excellent drummer, and I did my, you know, we played, we rehearsed, and a week later I had opened, and there you go.
My guest is Bette Midler. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bette Midler. When we left off, she was talking about her early career when she sang in a gay bathhouse in New York. I asked her to describe her persona at the baths.
It was the 60s, the very late 60s, maybe the early 70s. I was wearing a lot of vintage clothes because I loved vintage clothes, and my hair was very long and kind of frizzy, and they always put a backlight on me so that I looked like I had a halo. And the makeup was appalling, but there was a lot of it. And I always wanted to have a sort of a sexy appearance because I thought that that was a fun thing to do. I enjoyed looking and creating that image. And you have to love the illusion. And indeed, I did fall in love with that illusion. And she was divine. As they started calling me divine, they asked me how I wanted to be introduced. And I told them the very first night, you may call me divine. Tell them I'm divine. Well, what's your name? And I had a hairdresser who was a great friend of mine. His name was, we always called him Mr. G. His name was Bill Hennessy, but he went by the name Mr. Gerard when he was in the beauty salon, and they called him Mr. G, and he used to call me Miss M, and I called him Mr. G. And so I said, tell him they had heard me, Stephen Ostrow heard me, heard Bill calling me Miss M, and so that's how it came about. He heard me, he said, Miss M, and I said, tell him I'm divine, no, the divine Miss M, and there it was, and it stayed with me. He liked saying it, and I liked being it, and so there we were.
But part of what you were making was this alter ego.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I still look on it as my greatest creation. I do.
How do you relate to
fabulous.
The alter ego? I mean, is
not at all. How do I relate? It depends on the day. You know, sometimes I'm mad about her, and sometimes I think, oh God, I'm so wiped out. I'm so tired. Why doesn't all this just go away? So it depends.
Now, Barry Manilow became your pianist at the Baths in, I think, 1971. I think he was your second pianist there.
Was it 71? Yeah, I guess it was. Maybe it was 70. I think it might have been 70 because he was with me for 3 years, and I think he left in 73.
So he was not a known songwriter when he joined you?
Well, he was known around town as a jingle writer. I think he had a deal with Bell Records before we met.
Did he give you any suggestions of songs to add or things to do on stage?
We had a wonderful time together, but we were like an old married couple. The work was absolutely fantastic, but we bickered a lot. I was very cranky with him, and I think he was very cranky with me too, only because we both had very strong ideas, and there was a lot of push and pull there. But my memory of it was that the shows were fantastic, and that we pretty much had a ball. We had a wonderful time. We went so far so fast. And I think both our heads are still swimming from it, to tell you the truth.
Do you want to choose a record that you recorded with Manilow at the piano?
I must say, he did his version of Do You Want to Dance really is fabulous. I love the way he played that.
Good.
I love the way he played that.
Let's hear that. My guest is Bette Midler. That's one of her early recordings. Now she has a new CD called Bathhouse Betty. When you moved out of the baths and started recording records and reaching a broader audience, did you...
Oh, thank God we're reaching a broader audience. I thought we'd never get out of the baths.
Did you...
I thought we were going to be in the baths for this whole interview.
Did you change your image at all or try you know, new kinds of patter or new costumes or anything different on stage, new songs?
Well, I had a little bit more money to spend, so the costumes got a little better, looking, but they were basically in the same bad taste, which I think was part of the charm of the whole thing. I used to say... the patter got better. I met a lot of people. I hooked up with Bruce Valanche, who I still think is fabulous. He's a great guy. I met him in Chicago. He was writing for a Chicago paper, and he interviewed me. And we had so much fun that I asked him to write me a few lines, and he's been writing me a few lines ever since. So things did get better. I think I really did actually tone down when I got tired. I was hospitalized a couple of times in the 70s for exhaustion. And I just got so tired of being on all the time. And I said, I don't really want to do this. I would rather just be who I am and not have the stress and the anxiety of being this character all the time.
Well, one last question. I know you have a new movie coming out soon where I think you play Jacqueline Suzanne, the novelist.
I do.
Mrs. Valley of the Dolls.
It's called, the picture is called Isn't She Great?
Uh-huh.
And the character is Jackie Suzanne. And it's, yes, Jackie Suzanne was the woman who wrote Valley of the Dolls and various other novelettes. And she was a fabulous character, I must tell you. She's one of the most wonderful characters I've ever played. I really fell madly in love with her. She was very circumspect for someone who was involved in writing what people used to call trash. She was really quite refined. She never spoke of her personal life ever, and she had quite a personal life. She had cancer. Which she eventually died of. She had an autistic son who she was obliged to institutionalize, and she had lots and lots of heartbreak in her life. It was very, very interesting, and it's one of the best scripts I've ever read.
So also in this movie is Nathan Lane as...
Yes.
..as your husband?
Yes, Nathan Lane plays my husband.
And David Hyde Pierce is...
David Hyde Pierce plays my editor, plays the editor in the piece, and he's... his work is superb, and Stockard Channing is in it, too. It's a really good cast. John Cleese, there's a little bit of music in it. It's a riot. I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Well, great. Bette Midler, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Bette Midler, recorded last year after the release of her CD, Bath House Betty. She's currently on the Divine Miss Millennium Tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunewald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens intimately chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember actor and writer Quentin Crisp with an interview about his life in the 1930s and 40s as an open homosexual who enjoyed wearing makeup and flamboyant clothes. He died Sunday at the age of 90. And we remember Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm, who died last week.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember Quentin Crisp, who died last Sunday at the age of 90. Crisp became a cult figure after the publication of his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. The book was adapted into a film of the same name, starring John Hurt. Crisp came out in 1931 at a time when discretion was the rule for gays. He thrived on exhibitionism. He grew his hair long and dyed it red, polished his nails and tweezed his eyebrows, and wore more lipstick and mascara than was considered proper for women of the time. Walking around the streets of London, he was insulted and mocked by strangers, harassed by police, and beaten by toughs. His overt effeminacy condemned him to a life in the margins of society. Crisp moved to Manhattan at the age of 72. I spoke with him in 1986, when he was in his late 70s. I asked him why he dressed so flamboyantly when he came out, instead of trying to blend in and pass for straight.
I think because I never really had a chance. There are, of course, a lot of homosexual men who look just like people, and they have to choose whether they will make any statement, either implicit or in actual words, about their sex life, or whether they will, as you say, try to pass. As I looked so helpless, so hopeless, and could not really find a way of joining the rest of the human race, and I'm speaking of a time, of course, long before I dyed my hair or plucked my eyebrows or lacquered my nails or any of that rubbish, I never really had a chance. I either had to make a terrible hash of being a real person, or else I had to try to be like myself as well as I knew how. So the problem was not really what I would do, but how I would cope with what I was stuck with. Because even at school, I was an object of comment. Why do you walk like that? Why do you speak like that? Why do you say this? Why do you do that? So that, of course, in the beginning, I did what nearly everybody does. I alternately confirmed and denied. One day I would try to behave like a schoolboy, thinking I can't bear all this persecution. Then the next day, I would give that up, thinking it's all too humiliating. I would go on in the way that seems natural to me. Then the persecution was so great, I thought, no, I can't bear it. I'll go back to trying to be like a person. But by the time I left school altogether, I was nearly 18. And then I thought, well, it's hopeless. I will just be myself and try to endure the consequences. I knew they would be difficult. I didn't know how difficult they would be.
When you decided to be yourself,
yeah,
you started dressing very extravagantly. How did you dress then when you were young?
Well, of course, by modern standards, my appearance wouldn't be remarkable at all. In New York, on 8th Street, which is called St. Mark's Place, there are people with half their hair green and the other half blue, or the other half shaved off altogether, with Fenimore Cooper hairdos. And they say to me things like, well, what was it? What happened? And if I say, well, I did henna my hair, they say, and then? Because they just can't imagine that anyone in New York would ever be persecuted for what they wore.
So what were you wearing that was as eye-catching and
well,
outstanding?
Well, for instance, I wore a velvet suit. And people came up to me in the street and fingered this suit, saying, where did you get this? And why do you wear this? I wore sandals or even bare feet, and people would stamp on my toes. My hair was hennaed. But, of course, as I say, by modern standards, the fact that I wore makeup, or that my eyebrows were plucked, or that my hair was dyed. And they mean nothing now, but they did then.
when you'd walk down the street, people would really notice you. You got beaten up a lot,
too. They would notice you. They would shout at you. They would throw things at you. They would push you around. They would come up and stand in front of you with their faces 1 inch from yours and say, "Who the hell do you think you are?" And, of course, I didn't think I was anybody. I was only living a life which seemed to me to express my peculiarities, my personality.
You've said several times that you had a choice between being yourself or trying to look like a regular person or a human being. Did you feel like something less than a human being? Did you really believe in the inferiority of homosexuality?
I didn't really have any views in the beginning about homosexuality. My problem was never a sexual problem. It was a personality problem. I couldn't adopt all these mannerisms, these affectations, in a sense, that make you like a man. You see, at that time, and still to a large extent in England, you could have made a list of occupations, professions, clothes, gestures, words that were suitable for a man. And then you could have made another list of things which were suitable for a woman. And if you just move backwards and forwards, saying, "I don't really see that all these distinctions are necessary. I am in certain respects masculine. I am detached. I am unemotional. I am constant. And I don't think I have to explain that. But I am also physically weak, with tiny hands and feet, with a high voice. And I don't see why I should try and disguise this. This is simply the way I am."
When you first came out, what were the laws in England pertaining to homosexuality?
I think I'm right in saying that certain acts between men would have been illegal and you could easily go to jail. What most people went to jail for, the people I met when I was young, was, of course, soliciting prostitution. But then you can go into jail because you're a woman prostitute as well. But if you wore makeup or were effeminate, of course it was assumed you were a prostitute, which of course is quite absurd. Nowadays, I don't think this assumption is made anymore. You might dress in a flamboyant way and be a rock star, or indeed just be enjoying yourself. You would still meet the hostility of the world, but you wouldn't, I think, be any longer assumed to be doing something illegal.
Were you frequently harassed by police?
Yes, all the time. The police do everything from just moving you on to giving you a fatherly lecture, to, in the end, finally arresting me. And I was taken into custody, went to a police station. Someone had to bail me out. Then the following day, I was arraigned in a magistrate's court. But the evidence was considered to be insufficient to convict me.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with Quentin Crisp. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with Quentin Crisp. He died last Sunday at the age of 90. Your image of yourself, I think, was very caught up in your appearance and how you looked. Did it trouble you when you started to age?
Yes, it troubles you when you first start to age. Round about in your late 30s, you think, well, one day my looks will no longer be a weapon. Funnily enough, when a program was on television about what people thought about old age, not one of the people questioned said, I regret the passing of my looks. And I found that extraordinary, because that's the first thing. You don't start to feel ill when you're getting to be 40. You hardly feel any different. You hardly even tire more easily. But you do know that your looks are no longer going to stop everybody dead for at least a few seconds, which they do when you're young, because they simply couldn't tell whether I was a man or a woman in my 20s. And this really did give them some pause. And, of course, later on this is not so. When I was 40, I stopped dyeing my hair red and started to dye it mauve, somewhat as it is now, so that people could see that my hair was dyed, but could not accuse me of dyeing it to look young. But, of course, by the time you're 50 or 60, you're old to the world. And it always amuses me that some famous actress will die, and then the news will be brought out that she wasn't really 92, she was 93. And you think, they've kept this weird secret all these years. And to a young person, if you said, no, actually, I'm not 60, I'm 70, they would say, oh, yes, because it's the same thing. There's no difference to young people. Anyone over 50 is one of them.
Why did you move from England to New York? How long has it been?
Well, I first came here for a few days in 1977. And I came because I was invited. I could never have paid my fare to America. I have never earned, as regular wages, more than £12 a week. That's $25 in a good year. So I would have been saving up for 3 years to spend 3 days in America. But when I was invited, I came here. And the moment I saw New York, I wanted it. But that's not surprising, because I've always been American in my heart. And the moment I saw the movies, I wished I lived in America.
You've lived a very bohemian life. Have you in any way become more conservative with age in terms of, you know, your lifestyle, your apartment, anything like that?
Well, I don't think so. I live in New York in the same way that I lived in London, in one room, in a rooming house. And I lived in England for over 40 years, in one room, in a rooming house. So that I don't think my life has grown any different. I would say my appearance is more moderate. But that would have happened merely by growing older, I think.
You've lived alone nearly all of your life.
Yes.
And you once referred to your home as your dressing room, like you like to go home, go back to your dressing
room. Yes, that's right. Because my life is lived so consciously in the world, whereas another person can just go out and buy some milk and come back again, I can't really do this because I expect that people may speak to me and talk to me and ask me why I buy milk or whatever, so that I am with the world every minute that I'm out of doors. I'm prepared to be with the world every minute I'm out of doors. My behavior, therefore, is always circumspect out of doors. When I get home, there has to be some time when I do absolutely nothing. And now, because I am older and I tire more easily, I try to have at least one day a week in which I never leave my room, so that I don't reconstruct myself, pull myself together, go out in that conscious way.
Do you see life as theater?
I see my life, yes, as theater. And of course, in this, I am aided and abetted by New Yorkers, because there never has been a city which was so totally given over to the big time as New York. Everybody is a secret actor.
You've said that to survive your life was an adventure and to reach old age was a miracle. Do you ever look back and think about people who are probably not with us any longer, who I'm sure warned you that the life that you're living was a dangerous life and that you'd get yourself into all kinds of trouble and you wouldn't live very long, you'd die of venereal disease or get beaten up in the streets. And here you are nearing 80, looking terrific. I mean, do you ever...
I am reminded of that. The other day, I can't think what did remind me, but I said I can remember. And someone said, not behind my back, but to my face, you'll never live through another winter. And I was about 24 then. But of course, I was very frail. The thing is, people mistake a vast physique for a good constitution. They're in no way connected. When younger, I seemed to have an invincible constitution. I just survived.
Quentin Crisp, recorded in 1986. He died last Sunday at the age of 90. Coming up, we remember Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm, who died last week. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember Doug Somm, the Tex-Mex musician. He died last week at the age of 88. Somm is best known for his work as a singer and multi-instrumentalist in the Sir Douglas Quintet and the Texas Tornadoes. Before we hear a 1989 interview with him, here's the profile our rock historian Ed Ward did in 1988.
There probably isn't another musician in the world of rock and roll as confusing as Doug Somm. From one minute to the next, he's a blues singer, a Mexican conjunto player, a rock and roller, or a country and western singer. The thing is, he's good at just about all of it. Doug Somm was born of Lebanese parents near San Antonio, Texas in 1941, and showed himself to be a very talented musician at an early age. His mother encouraged him, and soon little Doug was playing steel guitar in honky-tonks all over Central Texas. He told me of a night late in 1952 when he was called to the stage at the Skyline Club in Austin and had to sit on Hank Williams' lap to play. It was Williams' last show, but all Doug remembers is how sharp his bony legs were. Doug finally rebelled against country music and began investigating the rhythm and blues scene in the largely Mexican west side of San Antonio. Soon, he was recording on local labels like Satin and Harlem. Some songs, like Crazy Daisy, were rock and roll.
You ought to see my crazy Daisy, but she's a-walking down the street. You ought to see my crazy Daisy, but she's a-walking down the street. She's the kind of a chick that every guy wants me. Oh, yeah. My loving honey, and I
But he also paid tribute to Sonny Ozuna and the Sunliners, a Chicano show band, with Just a Moment.
Just a moment of your time. Would you be just a moment with you?
These records were cut between 1958 and 1961, but they never got much beyond the San Antonio city limits. Doug had bigger ideas. The trouble was, Doug has always had a rather strong personality, and Sonny Ozuna's producer remembers getting besieged with phone calls from Som begging to record for him. The producer was Huey P. Moe, who called himself the Crazy Cajun. And as the man who discovered not only Sonny, but also B.J. Thomas, he was mainly interested in singers. Doug's sandy rasp wasn't quite what he was looking for. But Huey Moe was dealt a losing hand by the Beatles. One day he was riding high on the charts with records he'd produced in his tiny Houston studio, and the next day he couldn't get arrested. So he took a stack of Beatles records into a motel with a jug of wine and spent an entire evening listening to them to see what their secret was. If only he could find somebody to cut some songs like that, he thought. And then he remembered Doug. All it took was one phone call, and Doug and his band were in the studio, making their first really big hit, She's About a Mover. Propelled by Augie Meyer's Vox organ and somebody shaking some maracas, it stormed up the charts. But Huey decided to pull a fast one on the public. Figuring nobody'd buy a bunch of boys from South Texas, he called the band the Sir Douglas Quintet, photographed them in silhouette only, and tried to pass them off as British. Well, as soon as they did their first radio interview, that ruse was over, but they still got a modest hit out of The Rains Came.
Coming down, I haven't seen my baby since she left this town. Rain, 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 my pillow's soaking wet.
Rock historian Ed Ward's 1988 profile of Doug Som. One year later, I spoke with Som. He told me about the music he heard when he was a kid, growing up near San Antonio, Texas.
Going up there was great because we had country, we had blues. I was raised near a blues club. It was across a field about a mile. I could walk over there and hear T-Bone Walker. Late at night, I'd sneak out of the house and run across over there, and I'd watch T-Bone. Had a little crack in the window. It's almost like in that Jerry Lee Lewis movie where him and Swagger are little kids, and they sneak across the river. You know that part?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of like that, and we kind of peep through the window. And we really got the blues into my soul. I could go dig that one night. And then Hank Williams and Bob Wills were all playing around there. So, you know, people always ask me how I got such cross-culture of music. But I think that's it. I think at a young age it was really born into me. San Antonio was very, very, very beautiful to grow up in at that point.
So when you were a teenager, did you hang out listening to music in black neighborhoods and Mexican neighborhoods in San Antonio?
Oh, absolutely. That was the groove. We would, my school bordered on, it was really interesting. My school, Sam Houston Junior High, and went on to be high school, is now Jeff Davis Junior High. It had a little thing where you went down this road behind it, and once you crossed over, we call it Salal Creek. It's really Salado, but in Chicano slang, we call it the Salal. And when you cross over to it is where all the black places used to be. So we'd go over there, you know, and get a bottle of wine, sneak in there and play them nickel jukeboxes. And it was really a trip because it was a whole strip of nothing but rhythm and blues clubs. I'd have been about 13 or 14. By the time I was 15, I was working all those places.
In the early days of the Sir Douglas Quintet, you passed yourselves off as a British invasion band. whose idea was that, and what was the logic behind it?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It was a scam that worked. I don't know if you're old enough, but people watched Hullabaloo. Trini Lopez, it says, now we'll announce where these guys are really from. It was a big deal because we had, like, really pulled off this number. And, you know, Huey P. Moe, like I call him the P.T. Barnum of the South, he really pulled a number. And the whole bit really, really worked. We had these long, very regal coats. And, you know, it worked real well.
Your 1965 hit, She's About a Mover, was that supposed to sound like a British invasion hit? Did you think of it as sounding that way?
Well, the organ was popular at that point with the Zombies. We really liked the Zombies. And we really liked the Animals, you know. That was Alan Price.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a funkier sound. Like, when that record first broke, I remember Dylan had told me, I think, which sums it up. Everybody was trying to tell Dylan that we were English. He said, no, man, they're not English cats. Listen to that beat and that groove. It's got to be in the southern part of the States. So that's what really worked into breaking that whole Texas thing, because, you know, eventually we know that people really know we're from Texas. And, you know, we're Texans and we're proud of it, you know.
But you were walking down the street.
Did you try to put on a British accent?
Oh, we did a few. Pip, pip, man, lovely day. But you got to remember, there are three Spanish guys in the band, three Chicanos.
Right.
And every now and then, my drummer would break character and go, hey, ¿qué pasó, vato? Hey, ¿qué pasó? What's going on? ¿Cómo está? And all that. And we'd go, hey, man, cool it. And one time in Port Arthur, these two little girls heard that and go, they're not English, man, they're Mexicans. We kind of slipped, but it was fun, you know. Made us a very different bilingual band, you know.
Doug Somm, recorded in 1989. He died last week at the age of 58. We'll close with music by his all-star band, the Texas Tornadoes, which featured singer Freddie Fender, accordionist Flaco Jimenez, and organ player Augie Meyer, who was also in the Sir Douglas Quintet. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of John Glenn, a memoir. Astronaut, war hero, senator, husband and father, John Glenn tells his story. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the founder of Playboy magazine, Hugh Hefner. He edited the new book, The Century of Sex, Playboy's History of the Sexual Revolution. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.